Good evening and welcome to Transatlantic History Ramblings with Lauren and Brian. I'm Lauren from Swansea in Wales in the United Kingdom, and with me as always is...
It's Brian in the United States of America, Buffalo, New York, US of A, and I am so sorry we weren't here last week and we're a little late this week. I have been sick. It's all my fault. Blame me. Stop sending hate mail to Lauren. And she's not a bully. She didn't beat me up and knock me out of the show. I got sick and it happens. But I'm feeling better now, Lauren. How are you feeling?
Did people really email you that I kicked you out of the show?
No, no one really emailed me that you beat me up. No, but I've been sick. I had no voice for a few days, so we couldn't do anything. But how are you feeling, Lauren?
I am very well, thank you, because at the end of last week, I received some post for Transatlantic History Ramblings on behalf of us. It was an advanced copy of the upcoming Alison Weir book, Mary the First, Queen of Sorrow. So I'm ecstatic.
That cheering. Did you hear that, Lord? Did you hear the crowd going nuts?
I know.
You know why? It's not just that you got the package in the mail. It's that Allison's got a new book out, and we love Allison, and I'm going to have to reach out to her, see if she's ready to come back on her favorite show to be interviewed on. And I'm not just saying that, Lauren. She actually did tell me that her favorite place to be interviewed was here.
Oh, I have to say, it has that amazing new book smell. It is beautiful. And it was quite a surprise to have it come through, but it was... It was really amazing to have a book. I've been quite lucky to receive proofs of her other books in the Tudor Rose series. So really excited.
I'm excited for Allison because, like I said, we love Allison. I can't wait to reach out to her, see how she's doing. And, Lord, I can't wait. I don't even know if I could say on the air, but we got a whole bunch of really cool guests coming up. In the next weeks and months, there's going to be some fun stuff, including tonight is a surprise guest because people don't realize this, but Lauren will not be here for the interview tonight. And I'm going to surprise her with the guest too, because it's an old friend of ours. And when she actually tunes in, when this episode comes out, she'll say, "Oh, I wish I wasn't sleeping at 2 a.m. when they recorded this interview."
Yes. On a 2 a.m. UK time on a work day. Brian, how rude of you.
It's not my fault. It's when the guest was available. And to be fair, people, I did, you know, a couple days beforehand tell her that. And she says, no, you do this one on your own. Because there's been times when we knew the guest was going to be at like really weird times. Like, remember I had to wake up at like 3:30 a.m. that one time?
For Estelle Punk, yeah.
Yes. So I came home from work, took a nap, slept for a few hours so I could wake up then and do the interview.
And what else was there? There was one where we did an interview at 9 o'clock my time, finished around 11:30 midnight-ish. And then I had to be back online for 2 a.m. for Aaron Ra. I remember that.
Yep. So it's not me bullying Lauren or Lauren bullying me. That's just she was unavailable, but she's gonna love it. I didn't tell her who it was, but she'll love it. She'll be surprised. So we'll get to that in a little bit, but before we do that, Lauren, it's been a couple weeks since we've spoken because I couldn't talk. So what's new and exciting? Anything really crazy in the world of Lauren?
Not really. Everything's just been pretty much work orientated. So not much to say, unfortunately. I've been carrying on. Oh, I did have to have a ECG last week because they were a bit worried about the continuing health issues and they can't stabilize it. But all is good with the heart, which is what we want to hear.
Yeah, and how's your sheep?
I don't know. Brian, stop being xenophobic.
People write in and ask about the sheep now.
Oh, Brian, what have you brought?
You know who loves when the sheep come on the show?
Who?
Stop it, Lauren. Get him out of the room at least while we're recording. My mother loves the sheep. She does. She also loves my jokes. Lauren, you hate my jokes.
Oh, can we retire the jokes, please? We never did the jokes in the beginning.
I know. I love the jokes, Lauren. But I'm going to try a couple jokes, see if I can get you to chuckle a little bit, okay?
Okay.
All right. So, two whales walk into a bar, right? The first whale says, and the second whale says, "Shut up, Steve, you're drunk." Nothing?
No.
Did you at least like my whale noises?
No. It's pretty offensive to whales, actually.
Hey, Lauren.
Yes.
What's Charles Dickens keep in his spice rack?
I don't know, Brian.
The best of time and the worst of time. What, now you tell me you don't like puns?
No. That was just disrespectful to Charles Dickens.
You know who else doesn't like puns? Well, I don't know if it's that they don't like them, but you really have a hard time explaining puns to a kleptomaniac because they take everything literally. No?
No.
All right. Then how about this? So I went out to dinner the other day. Actually, lunch. I'm lying already. It was not dinner. It was lunch. But I went out to lunch the other day with my brothers and my niece. And my niece introduced me to the most amazing new app for my phone.
Okay.
You don't believe me. This is not a joke, Lauren. This is absolutely true.
I don't know anymore when it's a joke and when it's not a joke.
Well, this is absolutely true because it's a new app for my phone that I didn't know existed, but I don't know how I got along without it. It's called Poop Map.
Okay.
And it's like a social media thing. You can add friends and things, and wherever you are and you poop, you mark down where you are, the time and date, and leave a review.
Oh my God, that's right up your alley.
I know. And my niece told me about this. And then she's like, "You got to sign up, Uncle Brian. You got to sign up, Uncle Brian." And yeah. So I now have Poop Map.
Is she on Poop Map as well?
Oh, she's showed me Poop Map. She introduced me to Poop Map.
And she's,
but Lauren, you should sign up to Poop Map so we can do international poop maps. There is a function on there to take a selfie of the poop. Will not do that. There will be no selfies of poop in my poop map.
No, thank you.
But I think you should sign up for poop map.
Let me have a look.
Yeah, poop map. Oh, did you find it, Lauren?
Yeah, I'm not going to download it.
You downloaded it?
No, I'm not downloading it.
You should.
No,
because you could be friends with me and my niece on Poop Map.
No.
I'm on Poop Map. But
I'm but you know.
You could announce everywhere you poop in Wales. When you go to London, where your poops are in London.
I don't think I want to.
I don't know why. Pretty wacky, these kids these days, isn't it?
I know.
Like, When I was at school, they used to have this thing called poop shame. Like, you'd be, you wouldn't want to go to the bathroom in school because, like, you know, you'd be labeled as the pooper. You had poop shame. Now these kids are, like, posting when and where they poop.
I know. There was the same in our school as well. Like, you'd be terrified if you had to go poo in school.
Yeah. Nowadays, people are all about it. It's my how times have changed.
Children are bizarre. And when they call you, like, when my nephew, when Corey and Theo call me bro, and I'm like, I'm not your bro, I'm your aunt. Bruh. I'm like, what? I'm your aunt.
There's a friend of mine whose son is, oh God, he's got to be 10 or 11 now, but when he was six, he used to call his mother bro. What's up, bro? He would say to his mother.
I know, they say it to their mother as well. What's up, bro?
Like, yeah, what's up, bro? And I'm like, I don't know, that's pretty weird.
That is weird.
It is. Well, kids are weird. You were a weird kid too, I bet.
Yeah. Yeah, I was.
I mean, I was a weird kid, and you hear this ding on my phone like, yes, you were.
Correct.
We were all weird kids. Now we're weird old people. Well, you're not old.
Yeah.
You're weird. You're weird getting old.
Yeah.
I'm weird old.
We're weird adults.
Are we really adults, though?
No, not really. I don't feel like an adult. Like, I see I see people my age, and I don't feel like an adult.
Or how about this? Think about when you were a kid and you saw people who are the age we're at now. You're like, look at those stuffy old fuckers.
Yeah, I know. Like, oh my God, they're old.
You know, and I'm sitting here wearing a pair of socks with Beavis on them. When I was a kid, no 50-year-olds were running on in Beavis socks.
I was going to say, it's quite funny because, children shouldn't judge us because, you know, we don't have children ourselves, so we can just buy all the toys they want. And we don't have to ask permission.
That's true. I just sent you a picture, Lauren, to show you my Beavis socks to prove that I really do have Beavis socks.
On Facebook.
Yes. So, you take a look at that. And tell me how badass that is. But, yeah, these kids these days, they're all weird. They're weirder than we were when we were kids. I think the internet fucked everyone's brain up. What do you think?
I don't know.
Like, it's like an information overload.
Those are nice Beaver socks, though.
Aren't those awesome?
They are.
Yeah. I'm going to send you another picture while you're on there. I don't want you to comment about it when you're on there, but it's one of our upcoming guests.
I think I already see it. Yeah, you've sent me something. Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's going to be a great show.
It's going to be great. Indeed it is.
I really do. I think there might be information overload because, like, I was a nerdy kid who did a lot of research, you know, so I'd be in libraries and things and going through books and taking in as much information as I could. These kids now, you don't have to go to libraries. You can take in more information in an hour sitting at your home than you could in a month when we were kids.
It's kind of weird as well because they don't go, they would never go to libraries. They would never think of going to libraries.
They don't have to.
No.
But I mean, think about that. They can get in the space of an hour more information than it would have taken us a month to gather as researchers.
But they think they know.
Brain overload.
It's like there seems to be an unwillingness to learn as well. Like they don't
seem to
retain knowledge as once it did. And that's kind of sad.
for some, but again, I think that could be because it's information overload. It's almost like you don't, your brain is retrained that you don't have to retain knowledge because it's always going to be there at your fingertips. Which is weird, and I can prove that in a weird kind of way. Remember when you were a kid? Think back long time, Lauren. I know we're old now, but remember when you were a kid?
Yeah.
How many people's phone numbers did you have memorized?
Mine, my grandparents, like my grandmother, my mum's mum, and then my dad's mum and dad, and then that was about it.
How many do you have memorized now? None. See, because we don't need to.
No, I do know my own number off by heart.
Oh, my own number.
I came close to saying it to prove that I knew it. Gosh.
But think about that. When I was a kid, I knew my number, both of my parents' work phone numbers, my grandparents' numbers, my aunt's numbers, at least two or three friends of mine's numbers, one or two of my brother's friends' numbers. These were all in my head. I knew them all. Now, I know my number. I'm pretty sure I know my brother's number, but I could get the first three digits mixed up at times. But that's it. And you know what? Because we don't have to. Because everything's stored in their phone. Everything's there at the touch of a button. And I think that's what's going on with these kids, that they don't have to retain the information because they know it's always going to be there. I don't know. It's just weird.
It was like my nephew's about telling time. It took them such a long time to learn time because they were adamant they didn't need to know how to tell time because it was always going to be on their phone. But then, you know, when you tell them, but telling time just isn't about, you know, looking at a phone and saying it's 20 past one, for example, is about going, it's 20 past one and I have to be in work by 3 o'clock. How long does, you know, and how long am I going to have to get there? What time am I going to have to take a bus? It's about the whole time management.
Exactly. Although that reminds me, like when I went to buy a watch, last time I went to buy a watch, and I went into the store and I asked the guy, you know, hey, can I take a look at these watches? Like to buy one, and he says analog, and I said, no, just the watch.
I don't have a smartwatch. I refuse to have a smartwatch. I have a watch that isn't digital, that tells me the time.
You just walked right into that joke, Lauren.
Yes, I did.
All right. I'm sorry. No more jokes. In fact, what I'll do is I'm going to have you clear your throat.
Oh, no, before that, I've got something quick to say as well, because I did something. I put myself out there spectacularly, and it's exciting in a way. But I don't know if anything will come of it. But there is this network of consultants, historical consultants, that you can apply to join, and I've applied to join it, so keep your fingers crossed for me. Probably anything, but fingers crossed.
My fingers are crossed, and my toes. Remember when the Flintstones used to cross their toes too?
Yeah, that was so cute.
I do that because I'm adorable. No?
I just every time you mention the Flintstones, I keep thinking about what you said about what was going to happen when you die, and how you're going to be stuck sitting on a couch watching Flintstones for eternity.
Yeah, if people don't remember that my wish, if people say, do you want to be buried or cremated, and I say neither. I want to be taxidermied, and am I going to raffle off my corpse at the funeral, and whoever wins the corpse gets to keep it? But the only condition is they have to sit me out on the couch at least once a day to watch the Flintstones. That's it. That's my wishes. Do you think anybody will take me up on my wishes?
No.
I know my friend Janice will. If I die before she does, she'll do it. Janice will hook me up. She'll make sure that's done. No one else, I don't think, will, though.
I wonder what Father Joe makes of that.
Probably not much. Although he might like the Flintstones, who knows?
He probably, I would say it would be very likely that he likes the Flintstones, but he might want to have a discussion with you next time you meet about your choices, Brian.
Hey, the Flintstones are the greatest fucking show of all time, okay? No, no, so you can't even argue it. Is there never been a better show than the Flintstones?
Yeah, even Scooby-Doo wasn't as good as the Flintstones. Because they ruined it with Scrappy.
Yeah. I mean, some people say Gazoo ruined the Flintstones, but I love the Great Gazoo. Anybody who says the Great Gazoo ruined the Flintstones, them's fighting words, okay?
He's not in it that much, though. He's not in as much as Scrappy is in Scooby-Doo.
Just the last season of the Flintstones, that's right.
So.
Dub-dubs. He was the best. I love the Great Gazoo. All right, before I go off on the Great Gazoo for an hour, you better clear your throat.
Okay.
And give me a good one, Lauren.
Today in history.
That was a pretty good one.
Thank you.
All right. Well, what you got for me?
So I've got to caveat this with the fact that this Today in History came with a caveat that this is dated based on an old calendar. So Today in History, the 23rd of April, 1616, William Shakespeare died in Stratford-upon-Avon on what has been regarded as the 52nd anniversary of his birth in 1564. So he died on his birthday.
Yeah, we got to discuss this, Lauren.
Mm-hmm.
First off, there's still some people who don't think he was real.
Well, he was real. There is evidence that he was a person.
Oh, that's right. I'm thinking Santa Claus. No.
No, I understand what you mean, that he was a front for somebody. But the thing
is, that he was a front. But
we do have evidence that a man called William Shakespeare lived in Stratford-upon-Avon, had a wife called Anne Hathaway, and at some point went to London to be a playwright. And we attribute those plays to him. That doesn't seem like, I know this has come up again, that it was the Earl of Oxford, and I don't think it was. I think it was William Shakespeare. Because, you know, after his death, when the first folio is compiled, they talk about William Shakespeare being a man that was among them, that was an actor that acted with them. So whether he was a patsy that got given the plays, that's a possibility. You can't discount it. But people didn't remark about it at the time. They accepted that this man called William Shakespeare wrote the plays and acted with them. So it's kind of like, yes, you've got to go with the evidence and you've got to keep an open mind. But for me, I kind of think he wrote, I think he did. He wrote them.
Well, here's my problem. Every once in a while, I think to myself, you know, I've accomplished quite a bit in my life. You know, I've written and produced and directed a play. I've, you know, written a book. I've hosted this show. I've done this. I've done that. I've done this. And then I realize I'm only 2 years older than fucking Shakespeare was when he died, and look how much he accomplished.
Well, it was a different time, you know. He was writing to support a family.
Exactly. He didn't have to work day jobs to support himself.
Was his day job. He decided to leave Stratford and do this full time, regardless of his family. I mean, it's brave. So, you know, that's the thing you can't contest, that there was a man called William Shakespeare who profited from these plays.
No, what's brave, Lauren, is those fucking collars he wore.
Oh, the ruff, yeah.
I'll tell you right now, if he'd have worn that collar to my school, he'd have gotten his ass kicked.
So I think that while it's intriguing to have these historical theories and conspiracy theories, we have to accept that the people that put together the first folio were considered the man that acted among them, that brought the plays to them, to have been the author of the plays, and they must have seen something in that. I mean, you have... again, a way you can contest this is that people were giving Shakespeare their plays so he could help them get them past the Lord Chamberlain, who was the censor. I mean, there was a play that got rejected by the censor multiple times until, And it was a particular scene because it was something to do with Richard II, and Richard II was a king that was deposed. So there was that anxiety about that, and you don't want to incite rebellion, and that was against the censorship laws of the time. So, and then it got given to Shakespeare, and then miraculously it passed the censor. So they were giving it to a man that was definitely not the Earl of Oxford.
What's your favorite Shakespeare play?
Oh, I have to say Hamlet.
That was a good one. I think Debbie Does Dallas was mine. That was Shakespeare, right?
No.
Oh, okay. Actually, no, my favorite Shakespearean play is The Tempest.
I like The Tempest, too.
But Debbie Does Dallas was a close second.
Do you know what? When I was in university, the first time around, not the postgraduate COVID-y time around, I was in Sheffield, and there's a very famous theatre there called The Crucible, and they were putting on a production of Lear, and Emperor Palpatine was Lear. It was it was spectacular.
So you get to see the Emperor.
I did. It was very weird.
Did he shoot like lightning out of his fingers?
It was very strained.
Well, when you are Dark Lord of the Sith, you know, you could be restrained.
It was very good. He's a very good actor.
You know, I got to go off on a tangent here, Lauren, because you brought up the Emperor. The prequels are being re-released to theaters in America. I don't know if they are in the UK.
We did all that about 10 years ago, I think.
Well, those are the sequels.
Oh, do you mean 4, 5, and 6?
Yes.
Okay.
And because of the anniversaries coming up. So they're going to be re-releasing them to theaters here. And it's funny because when they came out, they were pretty much universally hated by Star Wars fans. But it's a whole generation later. So now there's a whole generation of kids that is their Star Wars.
What do you mean 4, 5, and 6? Or 7?
No, 1, 2, and 3.
Oh, that's what I said. The prequels.
Yes, Phantom Men. Yeah. So
yeah, we did that about a good few years ago. There was an anniversary. What anniversary is this?
God, this has got to be,
isn't it?
It's the 20th.
No, 1999. The 25th.
25th, yeah. So wow, it makes me feel old. But
I know.
It just hit me that there's a whole generation of kids now that are, you know, 30 years old, that this is their Star Wars now. So it is a big deal for it to be being re-released to theaters. But I don't know. It still feels weird to me because I didn't enjoy them the first time in the theater. And I've seen them a bunch of times since. So I don't know. You think I should go see them again in the theater just to give them another shot on the big screen, or just say, you know what, save my money?
I don't know, because I mean the prequels were the first time I'd seen Star Wars in the cinema.
So it means something to you. It's significant to you.
Yeah, but then Jar Jar Binks.
Yeah, I love the theory that he was actually a Sith Lord.
Or an energy vampire, just there to annoy everybody on purpose.
Did you ever see any of the videos of the theories that Jar Jar is a Sith Lord?
Yeah, I think I did.
Oh, that's awesome. It'd be great if he was.
Yeah. If he's out there.
Speaking of science fiction, before I go on to my day in history, I was talking to our dear friend and show regular, Chris Shelton, the other day, whose channel is doing wonderful, and everyone should check out his YouTube channel. Just look under Chris Shelton, all about cults and, you know, how to getting out of cults and learning all about cults. And he's a great guest. He's been on several times, but he's a big sci-fi nerd, as we are. And we were kicking around an idea about, you know, the Star Trek franchise seems to have run its course, and Star Wars seems to have run its course, and all these quote unquote franchises, the Marvel universe is just getting so threadbare that is there room for a new sci-fi franchise, maybe something based on something classic, to come back? And this is just us being nerd friends talking. I think that'd be a good topic for a show. Maybe we'll bring him on. We'll do that, Lauren. What do you think?
I think it would be good to discuss the history of science fiction, because I think it seems to go in a loop, doesn't it?
It does.
Superhero films, sci-fi films, monster films. But the monster films, the last time they came around, didn't do so well because there's meant to be a whole franchise of them, and that never really took off.
Although I'll tell you this, I'm so happy. For those of you who get Disney Plus, in the States anyway, they just added Alien to Disney Plus, which might be one of the best sci-fi and one of the best horror films ever made. Usually, sci-fi and horror are distinctly different genres, but Alien might be the one movie that fits both categories perfectly and could be an example of one of the best of both.
I think whatever happens on Disney Plus America is what we get. Disney Plus is one of the streaming channels. It's not like Netflix where you have US and UK. You seem to get everything at the same time.
Well, there you go, Lauren. That's my homework for you, is to go back and watch the original Alien again.
Well, I've had to put, because of Disney's Star, I've had to put parental locks on my Disney Plus, because Corey is now 12 and can he can go into my account and turn the kids' locks off and watch whatever he wants. He's really becoming a teenager, and it's nice to see him becoming a young man. But the teenager thing is just flashback teenage PTSD.
I hear you. Well. Anyway, you ready for my day in history?
Yes.
You're going to love this, Lauren.
Is it Fancy Rounders?
It is not Fancy Rounders, but it is distinctly American.
America.
Today in history, April 23rd, 1900, the New York Journal prints the first known occurrence of the word hillbilly.
That's cute.
The first time hillbilly was ever used in print was today in history. Now, in Wales, do you guys know what a hillbilly is?
Yes.
Okay, what would you describe a hillbilly?
I can't really articulate a description, but I would say, for me, it's the Beverly Hill Hillbillies.
Is what?
I mean, the Beverly Hill Hillbillies.
Yes, that's, good example. I'm glad you said that and didn't represent America like most people do and say, yeah, hillbillies, like in Deliverance. That's, it's another way of looking at it. Definition of a hillbilly is a term for people who dwell in rural mountainous areas in the United States, primarily in the Appalachian regions and Ozarks. You know what that means?
You're a hillbilly.
It means our dear friend and one of our favorite people in the entire world, Sarah Beth Hopton, is technically a hillbilly.
I think she'd accept that, though, and she'd be quite happy.
I think she would, too. She would proudly wear that moniker. But, so think about that, folks. When you want to label anybody that you think is a rube, a hillbilly, she's a brilliant writer, professor, doctorate, one of the great researchers in the world, and just one of the sweetest people in the world, but she's technically fits the definition of a hillbilly. And she'd look adorable in bib overalls, wouldn't she?
She probably has some.
I'm sure she does, because she did own a farm for a while.
She does. She did. I think she still has some sort of land and animals now.
She does. I haven't heard too much from her since she got married. She got all too busy with a husband to talk to us. That's not true. I still talk to her once in a while, but she is very busy, but with school and, teaching and. Yeah, she's always busy. We got to get her back on the show again. She's just such a sweetheart.
Mm-hmm.
She is. I still try to get her to come up to Buffalo, because it would be so funny, because she's not even 5 feet tall.
Oh my.
Yeah, and you know how tall I am. So I think it would be hilarious to have a picture of me and her together to post on the site.
It would be.
She's a sweetheart. There, yeah, I'm going to reach out to her soon. But what I'm going to do now, Lauren, is I'm going to prepare us for the new interview. So I am going to fire up the magic interview box.
It's the magic interview box.
And when we come back, there will be a special surprise guest for you to listen to, Lauren, and you're going to love it. So why don't you go ahead and flip the switch? All right, folks, this is going to be a good one because I was able to get one of our dear friends, show legend, historian, all-around great guy, and one of my favorite people in the world to talk to, Mr. Patrick Sirianni, the Niagara Falls historian extraordinaire, and we are going to have a nice, fun chat today. Well, I don't know if it's going to be fun or morbid or both.
No, no, I'm going to keep the more, try to keep the morbidity to a minimum. we can get to all morbid stuff on a special show like Halloween or something.
Yeah, well, there's plenty of that. But we're talking about daredevils in the falls because the last time you hear, we were talking about one of the legendary figures, Annie Edson Taylor, the first woman to go over the falls in a barrel. And you, being the ultimate historian and one of the great storytellers of all time, said, oh, there's better stories to than that to tell you. And I said, well, we're doing another show. And before we begin, I want to say this show was specially dedicated to our dear friend, Misha Malcolm, who actually made the trip to come up here to see the falls after your show. And
oh, yeah, you were saying something about that. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if her reason to come up here was to meet me because, you know, hey, who doesn't want to meet me? Or if it was the promise of the greatest chicken wings in the world at Duff's, or if it was to see the falls. But
it's a combination of all three.
I think so. But I think Duff's probably was the biggest wooing factor. But other than that, the falls just had her floored.
Well, you tell her if she ever returns, come on over to the Canadian side. And I'll take you and her for a ride. We'll take my 51 Mercury Monterey. We'll cruise the parkway, and I'll show her a few things.
Well, she'll be listening, so that's a definite.
I'm a retired guy, so I got lots of time on my hands.
And nobody knows it better there than you. And
there's a few others. Don't you worry.
There's a few, but none of them that are as much fun to talk to as you.
I guess I know it so well because I grew up down there. I grew up right on River Road. Like, you know, in the summer, it was like a Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn existence. We were always down in the gorge doing something, from throwing rocks in the water to scaling up and down or whatever. You know, we did that as kids.
Things you would not encourage your kids to do now.
Exactly. We never went home and told Mom where we were.
No.
No, you never did that.
And I got to also give a special shout out because my girlfriend, Sarah, is sitting here next to me, and she is another one who absolutely loves and adores the falls and is so happy you're back on. So,
okay, great.
Now, before we begin the actual stories of today, we're going to have to address the elephant in the room. As our regular listeners know, I live about 10 minutes from the falls, but on the American side.
Okay.
How, which means, you know, you're still supposed to come up here for Duff's wings. We got to get together and have wings.
Yeah, for sure.
But the eclipse, how crazy was it? Because, you know, they were anticipating 1 million people in Buffalo, which is where I am, 1 million people in Niagara Falls, which is where you were, and 500,000 people in Rochester of tourists just to show up for it. They shut down the entire city of Buffalo. All the businesses closed in anticipation of this. And it turned out to kind of be a big nothing burger.
Well, you know why? Well, I know why it would happen over here. Our mayor, Jim Dealdaddy, been the mayor for several years. Great guy. He really promotes Niagara. So, of course, he got into this eclipse thing, promoted it really well. And then the region, see, we're the city, and then there's the regional Niagara, which is a bigger area. The region called the state of emergency, not the city. So I think that them calling it a state of emergency scared a lot of people away. So instead of the million that we were kind of expecting, we might have got, I don't know what the actual number is, but it can't be over 200,000.
No. In Buffalo proper, it was busy, obviously, and, you know, the hotels got jacked up price to, like, over $1,000 a night.
Oh, God.
Because, you know, America. But my girlfriend works in the heart of downtown Buffalo. She works for Erie County.
Okay.
So she was telling me, like, the day before and everything that, yeah, it was a little busy downtown. Like, the restaurants and bars were a little bit busier, but nothing insane.
Yeah.
And then when she went back to work, she said everything was normal. There was no need for a state of emergency. So kind of a nothing burger.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is what it is.
It was badass to see, though, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was great. I just stayed right here in my backyard. I didn't go darn place. I just sat in the backyard and watched it get dark.
That's what we did. We went out right out in front of the apartment, sat down with a little portable grill, made some hot dogs, and watched the moon eclipse the sun. I mean, it was a good day. I'm not going to lie. It was a fun day.
And I got an extra pair of those glasses. I'm saving it for the next total, which is 2144.
Yep.
Coming by us. So, you know.
I think 2144 will be about 180.
I'll only be 180, but I'm saving my glasses for then.
Yeah, I got mine here, and she got the Buffalo Eclipse t-shirts and, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Merchandising went nuts. But you told me it was crazier down in Niagara Falls when Nick Lawenda did the walk across the falls on the
Nick Lawenda, yeah, I remember that night. That was wild. I was in Hamilton at the time, and of course I'm coming home to see that. So I came home, and I went over to up the Falls View area, opposite where the Minolta Tower used to be, up in that area. And I was across the street at Zappi's Pizzeria. I had a little sandwich out on the patio and a beer waiting for this to happen. So I walked across the street and met a nice old couple from Ohio. They were there on their, like, 50th wedding anniversary. They had no idea when this was happening. So when I told them, they got all excited. So what I ended up doing, they got the incline railway there. Takes you down to the Table Rock and gets you close. And you get an all-day pass. I don't know, it's $4 or $5. You go up and down. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go down. So I got on the incline. I went down. And I'm standing at Table Rock. And, of course, everybody's setting up and getting ready. And I look across over to the American side. What do they call that? Stedman's Bluff?
Bluff,
right down to the brink of the horseshoe. Everybody's basking in the beautiful sunshine over there. On our side, we're in the shade, and the wind was blowing the wrong way, and it was damn cold. It was getting cold. So I thought, the hell with this. I'm going back up the Falls View. So I get back on the incline, and I go back up because I want to get a cup of coffee. And the Tim Hortons at Table Rock, you were going to wait an hour. So I'll take the incline up. I get a cup of coffee up there. So I took the incline up, got a cup of coffee, had my coffee, went back to the incline to come down, and they were lined up down the street. I said, I'm not going back down. So I just stayed in Falls View. A gentleman came by. I forget where he was from, but he had one of those big campers. And he parked it right there in Falls View, and people were sitting in lawn chairs on top of this camper. So we had a bird's eye view. That was fun. And then, of course, Linda did his thing. After the event, I was over on the American side, a couple of friends of mine, and right at the brink of the falls, close to it, on the American side, they got that little memorial for Linda's feet, you know, with the cable stretching across. Yep. I'm looking at the cable, and I'm going, that's almost the size of a sidewalk. Because I had remembered, his history tells me, that Stephen Pier, who was a local man, he did a tightrope across in the 1870s on a 3/4-inch rope. And I look at this big chunk of cable Linda's doing on it, walking it on, and I'm thinking, what the hell? So what I did was I made mention of it in my Facebook group, Niagara History and Trivia, which I administer. And I said, well, Nick Linda, cable was 2-3 inches thick. The same with Blondin. And I said, Stephen Pierre, our local boy, he did it on a three-quarter wire. Well, guess who I got an answer from? Nick Walenda himself.
Like, yeah.
No, he was very polite. He wasn't rude about it. He just explained to me the fact that they had to use all these different guy wires to hold it steady. That's why it was so thick. And I said, I apologize. I had no idea. I will never mention this again, and I don't. But, yeah, he explained it in a way that made sense, and it was all good.
Nothing he does makes sense. He walked a tightrope across Niagara Falls. That doesn't make sense unless we're talking about the people we're talking about tonight.
Well, he was tethered.
Nick Malanda. He didn't want to be, though.
No, I know. I know. Well, we can get into some of those tightrope walkers at another time.
Yeah, but we're going
to start there now. We'll never get to this crazy summer of 86.
Exactly. So why don't you give us a brief overview of what we're going to be talking about today?
Well, you know, we got to look back a little bit in the history just before all this come down in 86. And the popular thing in Niagara Falls at the time was tightropes. Blondin, 1860, must have done about 20 trips back and forth. Samuel Dixon, Stephen Pier, Bellini, a couple other guys. So, you know what? When I look back at it, I think, well, maybe people were getting tired of tightropes, wanted to see something different. And I think that's where all this started. And it actually began maybe 10, 12 years before 86, when Joel Robinson, who was an American riverman, was given $500. They wanted to get the old Maid of the Mist down to the dock in Queenston because it had been sold. The Maid at that time wasn't making any money. So the owners wanted to sell it, but they, instead of tearing it apart and bringing it up out of the gorge and carrying it, Joel Robinson and another guy took it for a wild ride through the Whirlpool Rapids. But that's another story. He got it through, and it was sold, blah, blah, blah. And then Captain Matthew Webb, he was from England, first person ever to swim the English Channel. He came here to swim the rapids. He died in his attempt. So you see, there are things that were beginning to happen. And then in 1886... I think he was from the Philadelphia area, Carlisle Graham. And he was working in Buffalo as a cooper, build barrels. And I don't know where he got the idea from, but he just thought, I could take one of these for a ride to the rapids. So 2 weeks before he decides to make this attempt, he shows up at Niagara Falls, goes out to the middle of the old suspension bridge, and he's got a small model of what he's planning to use, filled with sand, and he drops it off the suspension bridge into the river, and he's got people down along the gorge to keep an eye on it to see how it does. So after that experiment, he decides, I'm going to do this. So what he does, he wants to make money, of course. He contacts the railway companies and wants them to advertise that he's going to do this event on such and such a day, and he wants a piece of action from all the traveling public that will come to see it. The railway, they told them, no, we will not get involved in any of that. We can't sponsor you. We won't support you. We won't give you any money. We want nothing to do with it. And the same thing happened to Webb. Webb came here under the impression, according to his manager, that the railroads were going to pay him money because so many people would show up to see him. And, of course, they turned them down, too. So anyway, Carlisle, damn determined, he's going to do this. So described by the Buffalo Press, he was a well-appearing young man, about 32 years old. He announced to the Buffalo newspapers, for the record, hey, I'm going to do this. I'm going to the Whirlpool Rapids at Niagara. Now, the Niagara Falls Gazette had quite the rebuttal when writing about Graham's announcement in July of 86 and quipped that, and I quote, it would make for a poor summer if some crank did not make himself notorious by declaring his intention to perform some impossible feat at Niagara, and that for a few years previously, over the falls, in a boat, balloon, or some sort of flying machine, was always the cry. Cranks often visit the area, talk long and loud about their plans, get their names in the local paper, and disappear.
Carlisle, on the other hand,
he claims to have been in the area for over 2 months getting ready for the trip, which he proposed to make July the 5th, 1886. Notice how it's right around your holiday?
Yep. Exactly.
July the 5th, 1886. And he told the reporter from Buffalo Express that the Whirlpool and Rapids are not as dangerous as has been imagined, and that the rapids could easily be passed in safety. So
okay,
here's
before you continue, we got to say, they're as dangerous as they look. We've been there. We've seen them up close. A lot of listeners probably haven't.
And here's his quote. I've been to the falls every Sunday since I arrived here and have studied the action of the water thoroughly. 6 weeks ago, this is a small barrel, I took the small barrel 30 inches long, similar in shape to the one I planned to use in my excursion. I weighed it down with 50 pounds of sand and dropped it off the old suspension bridge. I had men walk all along the bank, and its progress was carefully noted. 8 minutes sufficed for the passage through the Whirlpool Rapids, and in that time it did not go under once. When the barrel was taken for the water, not a mark could be seen upon it. So, now he's getting anxious. He's getting excited. Now, Graham was quite confident that his trip would be successful, and was planning to have him and his barrel rowed down the river to a point right about where Captain Webb had entered the water a few years earlier. The rapids, in his attempt to swim the rapids, at the appropriate location, the barrel and Graham would be dropped off the side of the boat and into the current. Claiming that if he was successful, a second, much more spectacular in nature, would be planned for him in his barrel. And this time, he wanted to drop with him in it, his barrel off the old suspension bridge in the water, into the water to begin his journey. That's like 190 feet in the air.
Yeah, that's a hell of a drop.
Now, his barrel was described as being somewhat in the shape of an egg, almost oval, and made up of staves that were 1.5 inches thick, and the barrel itself was almost 7 feet long. The barrel, Graham claimed, would enter the craft. The barrel, Graham claimed, would be weighted to have a draft of 4 feet, and he will enter the craft through a manhole on the top and fasten on the inside using canvas belt, which in turn would strap him to a bag-shaped hammock, which would supposedly keep him from striking the sides of the barrel. So he'd be like in a hammock suspended inside the barrel.
Okay, I get seasick on like a ferry boat. I can't imagine doing this.
Oh. Now, since Captain Webb lost his life attempting to swim the rapids in the summer of 83, it was thought that no one would be foolhardy to risk life or limb in a trip of sorts in a treacherous Whirlpool Rapids. As a matter of fact, it had been 25 years since the first successful run of the rapids was accomplished by Joel Robinson in 1861. And just I want to mention Joel here. After that event, mentally, he was never the same. That's according to his wife. He was never the same person again.
Well, how could you recover from something like that?
I don't know. Now, all the pre-trip testing conducted gave the somewhat adventurous Carlisle Graham a lot of confidence, so much so that efforts were made to have the railways pay him a percentage. This is where he gets into that. And, of course, they turned him down. But people were wagering. Many wagers were freely offered by his friends, but none were taken, that he would indeed go through the rapids. Some people looked upon him as being foolhardy, many more insane. While others suggested the authorities should prevent him from even attempting. Now, word spread on both sides of the community, both sides of the river, throughout the community. So you guys and us guys, that Graham was ready and would make his trip Sunday, July the 11th at about 2 p.m. And as expected, the event would see a rather large crowd gather on each side of the river bank to witness. Now, you know what? I can envision this. People hang out the bank to everybody. hundreds of people on the actual bridge looking down and all kinds of things. So what Graham did, he left Buffalo the night before, Saturday evening, and his plans were to stay at the Frontier House Hotel at Suspension Bridge, which is the north end of Niagara Falls, New York today. However, he did change his plan and decided to spend the night in the gorge below the Frontier House with his barrel, which was in place and ready for the trip. So, like, he wants to stay in the gorge because he doesn't want anybody bothering his barrel. So him and Buddy are stay there overnight. Now, with several horse blankets, Graham and one of his associates settled in the gorge for the night and kept guard of the craft. Now, about 5 o'clock in the morning, they were spotted sleeping in the gorge, and their appearance was seemingly suspicious. Constable Ed Mahoney was notified, and Graham and his accomplice were arrested and accused of being drifters in possession of stolen horse blankets. But it gets better. After failing to convince the arresting constable otherwise, the two so-called vagrants were marched up to the local lockup in the village of Suspension Bridge, and all of Graham's visions of whirlpool fame seem to be slipping away from him.
I love that it's also Officer Mahoney.
He had not been formally told as to what he was being arrested for and was beginning to believe that it was a ploy by local authorities to stop what they believed to be his foolhardy attempt. Lucky for him, though, several of his friends intervened, and Graham was released on bail with instructions that he was to appear before the court on Monday. As soon as he was released, he made his way to where the barrel was located. It began to immediately prepare for his trip. It was decided that the trip would be made that afternoon when a large crowd of people were expected to arrive from Buffalo. So, he gets arrested in the gorge.
I love that it's like the stereotypical 1880s cop. What are you two boys doing down there? I don't believe you. It's in every newspaper.
No. So shortly after 3 o'clock, Graham changes his clothes at the Frontier House, proceeds down to the Old Maid of the Mist Landing, where a boat was waiting to take him to his craft out into the middle of the river. While passing down the riverbank, he was spotted by one of the village trustees and was soon being pursued by two local constables. But before they could reach him, Graham was aboard the boat with the barrel in tow, and there would be no turning back. So he gets in his barrel, gets out in the river quick before they can get him. Now, as the craft entered the water a quarter of a mile above the Cantilever Bridge, his assistant, while fastening the lid before sending Graham on his way, inquired, "Are you all right? Are you sure you want to do this?" To which Graham replied, "I am bound to go. They will call me a crank if I back out now." The current was strong and the boat dared not delay, and he was quickly set off adrift at exactly 3:53 p.m. Okay, so here we go. Here's the ride.
Here we go.
At first, his barrel drifted slowly with the current and into a small eddy, where it rolled around several times before shooting out into the swift current and beneath the bridge, where it was submerged by the first big wave. From the cliffs above, the barrel looked like an ordinary channel buoy drifting downstream. Seemingly, it kept to the middle of the river and was often wholly submerged and rolling over and over. After the rapids ride, the barrel was carried across the whirlpool and quickly out into the river channel below it. So it goes down into the whirlpool. It goes around a couple of times. Now it's going to continue down the river. It left the whirlpool at 4:01. And by 4:25, it was floating amongst the boilers and little whirlpools below Lewiston Heights. So it does that. Now it's kind of getting out into the calmer waters of the lower river, down by where the
kind of water. Kinder. Not much. It's still pretty choppy there.
Yeah, but, you know, not as bad as the rapids.
Not as bad as the rapids.
Now, when he was passing through the whirlpool, Graham momentarily opened his hatch, stuck out his hand and waved to all who were watching, and quickly had to refasten the lid as a wave hit and rushed water entered his craft.
Now that is a badass Houdini-like move, putting his hand out and waving.
Now on the Canadian side, downriver in Queenston, now this is a Sunday afternoon. Back in them days, on the Canadian side, on a Sunday, you're not allowed to do anything.
No.
You can't even buy a newspaper. You can't go fishing. You can't do nothing. So anyway, old man Pendergast, Canadian fisherman, sat on his porch in Queenston looking over the river. Nobody in and around that location had been aware of what Graham was into upriver. So he yells to a friend of his, John, he said to a young man by the name of Kirkland, there's a channel boy floating down the river. It must have come down from Buffalo. Let's row out and get it. So old man Pendergast and this kid, Kirkland, they row out. They graze the side of the barrel. Graham could hear them and quickly removed the lid of his craft and stuck his hand out. Quite surprised, the old man almost fell out of the boat when looking inside.
I would imagine.
My God, there's a man inside. And was later quoted as saying, I looked in and the air that came out was hot as a furnace. He seemed to be all right, though. Only he needed air and we rowed him over to Lewiston. Now, arriving at the shore in Lewiston, Graham started back to Suspension Bridge Village by the overland route, almost immediately with a light wagon to bring his barrel after him. At the American Hotel, Graham quickly entered a room on the second floor for a change of clothes. A hearty handshaking followed, during which time Graham recited his experience. I am still alive, although some people thought I was a crank and was courting fate and braving the dangers of the whirlpool. But I stand here a witness of the fact that a man could ride the whirlpool rapids in safety. My experience while in the barrel? Well, certainly, I will tell it to you. After answering dozens of questions by admiring friends, he began. To tell you what occurred before we went out in the boat would be foolish, as you already know that. When they put me in the water, I closed the manhole plate and waited for developments. The barrel, laying in the sun all day, was awfully hot. But I made up my mind I would stand it. When I got into the barrel, the heat was so terrible, I thought I should roast. I should have waited until the inside got cool. But the officers were coming down the bank, and I had to drop in quickly. I tied the belt around my waist. But seeing it would slip down, I fastened myself with a rope, which I tied on after they dropped me from the boat. When I got out into the middle of the stream, I guess Hazlitt was his assistant, and you're going to hear more about him. When I got out in the middle of the stream, I guess Hazlitt was afraid I would back out. He asked me several times if I was ready to go, and despite the fact that I said yes, he held me. At last, he called to me and asked, don't you want to get out? I answered, no, drop me. And in a few minutes, I was sailing down the stream. After arriving in the whirlpool, I managed to get the manhole open and wave my hand. But I stopped the opening quick as the water dashed in on me and gave me a slight wetting. I found that just enough water wet my feet had entered, But I guess it was a good thing. It is, it cooled me down somewhat. Now listen to this line. The whirlpool is nothing compared to the lower rapids at Devil's Hole.
Wow.
Now you look and you see the whirlpool rapids, okay? Then you go down further, where Devil's Hole area, and you look at it. I mean, it's still churning pretty quick, but it's not, doesn't look like it's raging. But he said that they were worse, which I found really interesting.
I wonder if it's like an undertow type thing or something there that made it worse.
Well, it's deeper. And yeah, there's no rocks. And it's a narrow, the channel is narrower too.
Yeah.
So there you go. Okay, where were we? Okay, I'll tell you something, though. Before I quit, I do not intend to do this again for free. The loading of the barrel was such that if I had not been picked up in 15 minutes, I would have been ill from dizziness caused by the motion of the barrel. Now, while at the falls that evening, Graham's celebratory mood changed when he was taken charge by the suspension bridge constable and held at the local lockup to answer in front of the judge for his earlier charge of stealing horse blankets. Now, remember, he was out on bail, right?
And vagrancy, yeah.
At 8 a.m. the next morning, he appeared at court in front of Justice Eshelman, who formed the opinion that the blankets were indeed not stolen, and he was immediately discharged.
Okay, they're your blankets.
Okay, so now Graham gets a little bit of blowback. George White, barber from Oswego, came here yesterday with the announced intention of swimming the rapids this morning. Clad in a cork suit about 3/4 inch thick, he said last night from a Bird Street hotel on the Canadian side by the old suspension bridge. We had all these hotels on Bridge Street, okay? He said that he had successfully swam the Lachine Rapids on the St. Lawrence River and added, I know the whirlpool rapids are much worse, but with my cork suit, I can get through them all right. I went down along the bank and had the folks point out the spot where Captain Webb was killed. His mistake was trying to dive through the mountain of foam where the outside currents of the river surge to a peak. There is a sunken rock there against which he struck. In making my attempts, I will simply float on the surface, save my strength, push away from any rocks. If, as people say, I will be sucked under the surface by the undertow, I can stand it for 5 minutes. The current will carry, wait a minute now. The current will carry me along better underneath, and it would be best because the passage through only takes about 4 minutes. So somebody standing there listening to him says, expressing disbelief, that he could hold his breath for 5 minutes. So George White produces a large pill right there, quickly fills it with water, and sticks his head in it.
I'll show y'all I can hold my breath.
4 minutes. You fellas need not think I'm fooling, he said, for I intend to go through with it. I'll knock Graham and his barrel sky high, and he will not have a chance to exhibit himself much. So what he's saying is, I'm going to be better than Graham, right? So at 9 o'clock last evening, White heard that the Canadian detectives were after him, and he secluded himself. Before going away, White arranged with a few persons to witness his attempt, so there would be no dispute about the feat if he got through. The general sentiment, this is the Niagara New York paper, the general sentiment is that if White gets in the rapids, he will be killed. The police on the American side said they will not interfere with White. At 10 o'clock this morning, a crowd of people had gathered on the bank expecting White to make his appearance, but up to this hour, 10:30 a.m., he has not done so. So who knows what happened with this guy?
That's crazy. Now, next thing, as you continue, I just want to let you know, I'm going to be moving around. I won't be in front of my camera, but I will be here.
Okay. All right. The next day's commentary from the Niagara Falls Gazette. A careful search yesterday failed to discover the whereabouts of George White, who wanted to swim the rapids in a cork suit. The last positive record of him was late Thursday evening in the streets of Niagara Falls, Ontario. It's not known positive whether he stayed Thursday night. It is claimed by some that he is hiding from the police. And as soon as he can get away from them, he will make his trip. Now, the police, they make a mistake when they announce that they will arrest any person attempting to go through the rapids on the grounds of self-murder. The fact, known to a class of deadbeats who come here and make a great blow of what they will do, get in the newspapers and skip out for fear of the police interference. At present rate, there will be several more just such cranks here before the season is over. And they should be given the assurance that if they come here to swim the rapids, they must do so within an hour of arriving or leave town.
You got 1 hour. Get in and out of those rapids.
Man, it spends a day and night traveling from saloon to saloon with some sort of invention, which he says will safely carry him through the rapids. Getting drinks by exhibiting it will never be missed by the country at large. Oh, man. And now here, the competition. True competition now. Now, Hazlitt, he was assisting Carlisle Grimm in the construction and all the things to do with his barrel. But afterwards, he was pretty much shunned by Grimm. So him and his buddy, William Potts, they decided they were going to construct a two-person barrel.
I wouldn't want to be in a two-person barrel.
In order to outdo Grimm, with a plan to ride the treacherous waves of the Whirlpool Rapids together. This new water vessel was 10 feet in length with a thin steel divider in the middle. And it had a 12-inch propeller wheel on its stern, workable from inside by the occupants. If their voyage was indeed successful, then the pilots, Potts and Hazlitt, hope to modify the craft into some sort of emergency lifeboat. Now, in them days, everybody was trying to build some kind of a lifeboat for the high seas. There's another man from Niagara Falls, New York. Name was Percy, Captain Percy. He was involved in all kinds of construction, different things. And that continued right up until 1915 when Bobby Leach went over the falls.
Yeah.
He got his idea from a man whose name was Mitchell from England, brought over a big barrel contraption. And then in December, they tested it, sent it empty over the Horseshoe Falls just to see, how strong it was and stuff like that. So, yeah.
Spoiler alert, folks, it's pretty strong.
Oh, you're making me laugh here. Okay, so, completed on Saturday afternoon and test of floatability, it was launched into the Upper Niagara River at Black Rock, you know where that is, American side. A party of six were involved in the endeavor, which included the two crewmen, and the plan was to tow it across the Niagara River to the Canadian shore. It passed the seaworthy test more than satisfactory. Unlike the skiff that was being used to row it across, quickly took on a lot of water. The trip across the river had to be delayed until a more seaworthy boat can be found to tow it. After obtaining a loaner, the barrel was floated over the Canadian shore to Chippewa and landing there at about 11 o'clock that night. They remained there at the house of James Hazlitt, that would be his dad. And about 8:30 Sunday morning, the party and barrel were taken down to the Maid of the Mist landing on the Canadian side. That's where it still is today. That's where the landing is. Yeah. Okay, the announcement of their voyage brought thousands of people from many of the neighboring cities. every regular and excursion train arrived in and around Niagara completely loaded with thrill seekers. So everybody and their uncle were coming in. And by 3 p.m., the banks of both sides of the river and bridges were filled with people. That, you know, I can imagine this. At the main landing near the falls on the Canadian side, preparations were being made. And enough of Potts and Hazlitt's relatives were on hand that one could call the crowd there a small colony. Alex Hazlitt asked at his master's ceremonies, while William Potts' father, with pipe in mouth, entertained the newspaper. Now, because Graham had complained about the intense heat in his barrel, preparations for this voyage included large pieces of ice placed inside the craft beforehand in order to cool the temperature. While waiting to go, William Potts stood off on one side looking cool and confident, while Hazlitt looked slightly phased and quite nervous about the whole ordeal. Yeah. At the last moment, both men suited themselves with a shirt and drawers and put on light moccasins on their feet. And when both men denied any misgivings as to the success of their passage, they had planned to hire Captain Carter. Captain Carter, he was of the Maid of the Mist. He would later be one of the first mayors of the city of Niagara Falls. They asked Captain Carter to tow them to a starting point. However, at the last minute, Captain Carter backed out. He had decided that he did not want to be a party into what just might be a sad ending. Luckily for Potts and Hazlitt, there were two small crafts and pilots who were only too willing to tow the barrel out. And after a delay of almost 2 hours, the cry finally heard all along the riverbank. Here they come. At precisely 4:45, the barrel, with a small American flag floating at the stern, was turned out into the stream, and the barrel was finally let loose 200 yards above the Cantilever Bridge. The crowds on the bridges held their breath and watched as the craft struck the first breaker in the rapids and was whirled around. From there all the way to the roll pool, they experienced a series of tumbles, first on the crest of the wave and then out of sight beneath the heavy breakers. If the craft passed the incline railway on the Canadian side, it was witnessed turning over in a complete somersault. And somehow the barrel survived buoyantly and continued to do so with a small flag attached and floating triumphantly. It was a quick ride to the Whirlpool Rapids, lasting about 2 minutes. As it entered the Whirlpool, it was seen to be closer to the Canadian side. Standing out on the furthest point of the Whirlpool outlet below Thompson Point was William Potts' father, who hailed his son in the craft and received an answer from him, "We're all right," which seemingly eased the old gentleman's mind very much. The passage through the Devil's Hole Rapids, simply a repetitive of the first part of the trip, the barrel would roll and pass out of sight with the American flag always coming on top in good shape.
Now by that's...
Yeah,
that's pretty cool that the America, the flag. Kept
yeah, well, there's no Canadian flag then.
No, that one stuck. The Canadian flag was getting a beer, having a good time.
By 5:19, the barrel had reached the still waters under the old Lewiston Bridge when it was picked up by Sam Hazlitt, George's brother. During the later portion of the village, the voyage, the two men climbed out on the deck of the craft and rode astride on it for several hundred yards. Neither of the men were much disposed to talk of their experience after arriving on shore. Both of them had been well shaken up and jolted, and they felt disposed to be thankful they had come out of it so lightly. Neither man had regained their equilibrium to explain their sensations, but both of them acknowledged that events transpired so quickly there was little time to be afraid. Potts did speak briefly and said, "Graham said the Devil's Hole was the worst, and that's exactly how we found it." I just can't get over that, you know?
I can't either, but I'm like, why would he lie?
Exactly. With the exception of a few paint scratches and a little water leaking through a manhole plug, the craft was dry, ship-shaped inside, as it was before the start of the trip. Now, Hazlitt, he accompanied the barrel back to Chippewa. Potts went over to the American side going to Buffalo that night on the 927 train. at Spencer House. He and his father were met by a representative of the Gazette newspaper. And when asked about the sensations while passing through the Whirlpool Rapids, he could not tell. The fact is, with all the rolling and tumbling, there wasn't much opportunity for observation. No question about the voyage.
Yeah, I was and too busy rolling and tumbling to think about what was going on.
And being dropped from the railway suspension bridge, Potts replied, that would be the last trip any man would ever take. Because Graham had said previously he wanted to be dropped from the bridge. Now, the men in the barrel were to be on exhibition in Buffalo for a few days. And if there's any money in it, another trip will be planned for next Saturday. The following day, Potts and Hazlitt were visited by Carlyle Graham, who offered a challenge. On Thursday, the 19th of August, Graham says he plans to go them one better by dropping from the railroad suspension bridge and then float down through the Whirlpool Rapids. This will be the most daring feat ever performed in Niagara, and it is understood that Graham will extend the Potts and Hazlitt to drop at the same time. In another interview, Graham stated that if successful in this endeavor, that he would begin studying the falls with the idea of passing over it in his craft.
Okay, you know, I understand some people are adrenaline junkies, and some people are just out for a quick buck, but this is insane. Why would you do that?
Complete insanity.
I mean, I can imagine thinking, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to go over the falls in my craft, and it's going to be badass, until I got up to it and was standing there, and then I'd go, holy shit, never mind.
Well, you know, this last line that he makes. In another interview, Graham stated that if successful in this endeavor, that he would then begin studying the falls with the idea of passing over it in his craft. I had always believed that going over the falls in a barrel was Annie Edson Taylor's idea. Because in one of her books, she writes, the idea struck me like a thunderbolt. Go over Niagara Falls in a barrel. But here, Graham, 20 years before, was planning it. So where did she get the idea from? Carlyle Graham, of course.
Do we know that he meant his barrel? He said craft. I still want to get... I love Annie. The Legend of Annie makes my heart warm, so I want to give her all the credit. You know that.
All right, I'll let that go then. Dubbed the hero of the Whirlpool Rapids, Graham made his second trip through on August 19, 1886. As mentioned, the original plan was to have his barrel drop from the railroad suspension bridge to begin his ride through the rapids. However, the authorities on the bridge refused permission, and Graham was forced to begin his trip once again from the old Maid of the Mist landing.
You know, I want to interrupt for one second, because we've mentioned the Maid of the Mist several times. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners, especially the ones over in the UK or in Australia, around the world, might not know what the Maid of the Mist is. And if you're ever in the Niagara Falls area, the Maid of the Mist, if anybody says you should do something touristy, the absolute best bang for your buck in the world of touristy things to do, in my opinion, is the Maid of the Mist boat ride. It's still less than $20, I think, to go on it. And explain to them what the Maid of the Mist does.
Okay. The Maid of the Mist takes you in front of the American Falls on a boat. Railings all the way around. You stand at the front, stand wherever you want. You're going to get a view of the falls. And then it gets right up in front of the 2,200-foot Horseshoe Falls, very close, and the boat rocks. And it rocks, and it rocks, and it rocks. And then they bring you back. You're going to get wet from the middle of the falls. They supply you with raincoats. They've been in operation since the 1830s. They've never had an incident. You know, these captains that run these boats, they know exactly where they're going. They do it so repetitively. Although they've changed the name of it on the Canadian side. It's now called Niagara City Cruises on our side. a different what's company.
What's amazing, though, is like you said, you get on this boat and you get right to the base of two of these falls. I mean,
you know what?
You get soaked. It's amazing.
I lived here all my life. Never got on the Maid of the Mist till I was like 26, 27 years old. And I was driving a tour bus in the park. And I was impressed. And it takes a lot to impress me. But I got on it. That was the first time I ever bothered to get on it. Now, I've lived here all my life, but it was spectacular. You know, it's just something, especially on a sunny day. Then you got the rainbow shooting out of the mist and great for photographs. And one boat going up to the falls passes the one coming back and everybody waves at each other. You know, it's a fun touristy thing.
And it's very touristy, but it's so cool because you're getting that close to one of the most powerful forces in nature. And it's cheap. I mean, for what it is, the cost of doing it is, it's less than a round of mini golf at any other place.
And, you know, you're up close and you're in front of 45.5 million gallons of water coming over every minute. Yeah. You know, and there's something awe about that, something almost mystic about that, the way it just comes over. Yeah, fabulous.
And you get to keep your little rain poncho.
Yeah, you know what? Especially if you get there on a hot, humid day, I'd be ripping the rain poncho off and just letting it soak me.
Just letting it soak on you.
Down. I've done that before.
Yeah, not only do you get that ride, that awe-inspiring experience, yeah, they're cheap little plastic rain ponchos, but that's a souvenir, too. I mean, a souvenir.
Yeah.
Incredible. I've lived here my whole life, and I'm still in awe of the Maid of the Mist.
Yeah. Certainly spectacular.
Yeah, it's unreal. Back to our story of daredevil wackiness.
Okay, where we leave off? Yeah, Grand Vero had been on display at the then new Whirlpool State Park. You know where that is. Close to the elevator house that took passengers down to the gorge for a view of the rapids. In the early morning of Graham's scheduled stunt, the barrel had been torched by some unknown arsonist. Obviously, somebody had a personal dislike for Graham, but luckily it was put out quickly and the only damage the barrel suffered was scorching on one side. So about 3:55 p.m., the craft was cast off from the shore and quickly settled into the swift drifting stream. But unlike the first trip, Graham had decided to give the 10,000 witnesses lining the banks of the river and bridge an extra thrill by riding the entire distance of the Whirlpool Rapids with his head exposed.
Oh.
With his head exposed. All seemingly went well. And Graham and his barrel whirled around for the first time near Manning's elevator. His head and face could be clearly seen by all. Several times during the ride, the barrel dipped out of sight and below the water surface and finally entered the Whirlpool Rapids 5 minutes later. Now, there was a man by the name of Carl Toll who was waiting at the Whirlpool Rapids to conduct a rescue of Graham when his craft got in there. Luck should have it that the barrel, after entering the Whirlpool, circled once and passed very close to the shore on the Canadian side, which would cause for a very undramatic rescue, as it quickly was stopped and hauled to shore. Speaking to all concerned about the trip, they'll say he was smart this time. He didn't take the lower rapids, just went as far as the Whirlpool.
Yeah.
Speaking to all concerned about his trip, Graham said that the weight of the waves did not bother him in the least, but the spray really strangled him, and $1,000 would not tempt him to repeat the trip again with his head and face exposed to the elements. And he was quoted as saying that he's quite doubtful he would have been able to survive if he had continued his trip through the Devil's Hole Rapids.
The Devil's Hole Rapids, man, it just gets worse and worse with every person.
Yeah. During the early afternoon, While waiting for Carlisle Graham's extravaganza to begin, several people had gathered at the roll pool to be a witness to the day's events. A man from Lewiston, well known as a local crank by the name of James Scott, attended, and while hoping to conduct a dramatic rescue of Graham and his barrel and collect the $10 offered for the feat, he spent his time waiting by giving diving and swimming demonstrations at the whirlpool. He had previously been involved as a witness to Captain Webb's inquest, which followed that unsuccessful swimming of the rapids a few years previously, and he received public ridicule when a dummy made of the missed boat was sent to the rapids and he had to be hauled off the deck. So what they did was, when they did the inquest over Webb, they sent a dummy boat through the rapids and he wanted to get on it, but they wouldn't let him. Huh. Now, the demonstration of what he believed to be his great swimming abilities, that's this guy, came to quite an abrupt end. He dove into the water below Thompson Point, and the river quickly swallowed him up and drowned him. His lifeless body was found later that day, floating in the river near Lewiston. And local press later reported that alcohol and drunkenness may have been responsible for Scott's death, as he was seen drinking quite heavily all day.
I don't like to laugh at anybody dying.
Well, but, you know, the guy was a bit of a lunatic.
The guy's nutcase, and he's like, I'm going to teach your people how to swim in this shit, but let me have another drink first.
Yeah. Now, two men by the name
of Lewiston, you said? Rebecca.
What's that?
He was from Lewiston, you said, right?
Yeah.
A lot of the people I know from Lewiston today would do that, probably. I'm not saying drown themselves. I'm saying have their drinks first.
Two men by the name of Primo and Becker publicly announced a challenge to Potts and Hazlitt to race barrels through the Roll Pool Rapids for a wager of $500. They accepted a challenge, but later delayed the event because of the James Scott drowning. And Potts and Hazlitt are upset because the railways bring many people to Niagara for these events, but refuse to give any to barrel stunners. So the challengers, they leave town. So these guys come and say, well, let's have a race. And then,
and you're talking $500 at that time is a lot of money.
Yeah, lots of money. Now, Professor A.L. Davidson, a professional swimming instructor, he announced his intention to riding the waves in the Roll Pool Rapids on a raft made of beer kegs while fastening himself. So what's he going to do? He's going to go through on a raft of beer kegs, tie himself down to the top of it. It never happens. These are just some of the cranks. Now, you ever hear of a fellow by the name of James Kendall?
James Kendall.
Yes. He was a member of the Dawes Detective Agency located in the Boston area. Now, he read in a local paper about successes in Niagara, and he remarked to his friends, any fool can go through the rapids. Why didn't somebody swim it? Before the conversation ended, Kendall had wagers totaling $1,000. That he could accomplish a swim through easily with a cork life preserver and coast out all right. Several other wagers were made, totaling $10,000, a portion of which Kendall receives if he attempts and survives. On the following Saturday evening, he left Boston for Niagara Falls to do or die. Arriving at the bridge Sunday morning, he walked the river for the first time and had a look upon the rapids at Niagara. Now, he's not walking down below close to the river. He's up top on the rim taking a look, okay? They seem somewhat angrier than what was anticipated, but this did not dampen his determination. He then rode a streetcar up to the falls area, getting off at the Western Hotel, where he checked his baggage and question a hotel clerk by the name of William Walker as to where he could hire a hack to take him over to see the falls. Returning back to the hotel around noon, he told Walker he needed a single rig for a drive and proceeded to tell Walker he was going to swim the Whirlpool Rapids. Walker supplied a one-horse, two-seated wagon, and the two of them started for the suspension bridge, stopping at Walker's residence for some lunch. After arriving at the suspension bridge around 2 o'clock, they met up with a couple of Walker's friends, and together they walked down the hill with Kendall, who was smoking a cigar, totally unconcerned, as if swimming the rapids in Niagara was an everyday occurrence.
Arriving, yeah, these aren't normal people.
Arriving at the Old Maid Landing, Kendall took off his clothes, with the exception of red and white bathing suit, put on his cork preserver, and just quickly dove into the water. After telling those in attendance, I'm going for a little swim. He swam out directly in the swift drift. Now, the Niagara River, it's not so pronounced anymore, but they call the middle of the river swift drift because the current in the middle moves much quicker than closer to the shore. So anyway, he gets in the swift drift. And the swift drift, of course, carries him to the rapids. While looking up at the bridge, he waves to Walker, then quickly passes into the rapids and out of sight. By the time Walker and his friends arrive at the whirlpool and ride the incline down, Walker had arrived at its shore and could be spotted laying on his back. So Walker gets down to the shore at the whirlpool, and there's Kendall laying on his back. The man aided Kendall with copious amounts of whiskey.
Yeah.
And with vigorous amount of rubbing, soon brought him around. After returning to the top of the whirlpool on the Canadian side, Kendall was dressed, driven to the Waverly House in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Upon arriving there, he had sufficiently recovered to autograph several cards and showed no signs of nervousness whatsoever. After a brief rest, he returned to the Western Hotel on the American side, and here Kendall was interviewed by a Gazette reporter and gave the following report of his trip. After getting out of the Canadian eddy, I struck for the center of the river and swam slowly along down, saving all my strength I could. After passing over the first big swell, I found that I had no control over myself and realized I was turning somersaults and was being thrown about. When I got the chance to draw a breath, I tried to hit a wave, but would gradually strike me before I could hardly do so. Just before the buttery elevator, I thought I was near the American shore, so I could see rocks, and I made an effort to avoid them. When I entered the whirlpool, I knew where I was and started to swim across. But when I was in center, I got caught in a whirl, and after spinning around, I was sucked down under. It seemed as if I went miles. I thought it was gone and would have sold out for 3 cents. I was quickly thrown to the surface, almost unconscious, with little or no strength left. And as a last struggle, I threw myself on my back and kicked for shore. Although a good swimmer, it availed me nothing in the trip, and my survival was simply a miracle. The next 100 men who try it might lose their lives. There's not enough money in the world to make me ever attempt it again. Oh, wow.
It makes you wonder what kind of person he was. Was he a sociopath? What was wrong with him that he seemed to have no nerves about this, got there, looked at it, stripped down, and basically said, see ya, and jumped in without fear? I mean, That's what kind of...
I think I'm thinking ignorance was bliss.
Yeah, that's part
I would of it imagine too. If he was a person that grew up here, perhaps, and knew the river a little better, you know, it would have been a different story. But I mean, just coming from Boston, he's never been to Niagara, looks down from up above, I can assume. And then maybe, too, when he's traveling down the Maid of the Mist Road, he's got a safe face because he's got those other guys with him.
Yeah.
So he's got to act like, there's nothing, So who knows? Now, another crank comes forward after the Kendall event and claims he'll go over the falls. Jacob Chanier, a 32-year-old Cooper from Lancaster, New York, claims to be building a barrow and it will be ready in a fortnight, and tells all that he's quite familiar with the Niagara River. And in the end of the article, the writer reports that so is James Scott, who took a leap in a rural pool while drunk and lost his life.
Yeah.
Another guy, Jack Long, a champion featherweight fighter from New York City, arrives in Niagara on August 25th and announces his intentions to jump from the new suspension bridge just north of the falls, a height of 196 feet that is assumed to break recent records, as it is considerably higher than the Brooklyn Bridge, and he's anxious to do so. The jump was not conducted on the day of his arrival, as he deemed the local police would not allow it. Several other dates have been mentioned, but for one reason or another, his jump was postponed on several occasions. Finally, one afternoon, he prepared for the jump with two assistants ready and waiting in a boat below the bridge, but decided to cancel because his plan required two boats to be waiting. He then quickly left town, proposed to return the next day to complete his task, and is never heard of again. Wow. Ex-counselor George Chambers of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, had made a decision to swim the rural pool rapids at Niagara Falls. He says he will start next week, and if nobody interferes with him, he'll swim the rural pool rapids without a cork jacket, barrel, or anything else. And will depend on his power as a prolific swimmer to carry him through. He believes that any man can accomplish the task if he keeps his cool and doesn't lose his head. But of course, he never shows up. Well, I'm going to have to end it here. I got one or two more stories, but I'm going to save them.
Yeah, these are fantastic. And, you know, I was just thinking, I mean, I love having you on. I love these stories. I love history, as you know. One of our show friends, a very good friend of the show and a regular, is a man by the name of John Cox, who is the world's leading expert on Harry Houdini and a Houdini historian. Oh, and yeah. I would love to get the two of you together to maybe talk about the Man from Beyond movie that Houdini shot in Niagara Falls.
Well, I don't know too much about that. Although
that's why I put you on with John, because you would love it as much as I would hearing about it.
Now that would be interesting. I do know he was here, remember filming. And as a matter of fact, I got a picture of a canoe going right at the brink of the falls, ready to go over with two people in it. Mm-hmm. But it was a couple of dummies that they had used. But from a distance, from where the photograph was taken, it looked like it's real.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, you know, I never paid much attention to Houdini, even though, you know, he's a Niagara icon. We had the Houdini Museum here. They had seances trying to contact him, and there's a few stories like that. Yeah.
Yeah, that and that footage from The Man from Beyond, 1914, off the top of my head. I could be wrong. John Cox will yell at me if I am.
But I think it was in the early 20s, wasn't it?
No, it was the teens.
Oh, yeah, okay.
But that footage... Thomas Edison
had something to do with that, too, didn't he? Wasn't he responsible for filming that? Or
he filmed some of the stuff, but not that movie.
Okay.
But that movie, if you look at all this footage, is still some of the most heart-pounding footage you'll ever see of Niagara Falls stunts.
Yeah, yeah.
It's amazing. And what else is amazing is you, my friend. And I am so glad you were able to come back on.
But you know, you got to remember, back in the day, they weren't taking water from the upper river like they do today.
No.
They're taking like almost 60% of the water before it reaches the falls. So, you know, when you look at it, you think the rapids are fierce now. What about then? You know,
yeah.
Back in the day. Hell yeah.
Probably at least twice as insane.
Yep.
Well, all I know is that we got to get you on more often, too, because these shows are as much fun for me as they are for the audience, because I love this stuff. And even more importantly, we got to get you into Buffalo soon so we can get some wings together.
Chicken wings. Yes.
Oh, Duff's love wings. Them. Plug the Facebook group so everyone can go and check this out again.
Okay. Me and my buddy Jimmy Brown, we have a group called Niagara History and Trivia. And we now have over 40,000 members. So it's grown quite well. Occasionally I'll write a story and put it up. Hundreds upon hundreds of old photos. If you type my name in and search it, I'm sure stories will come up. There's no messing around with this group. Nobody's cursing and swearing. Nobody's arguing. Because at the first, it's monitored. And at the first hint of trouble, you're gone. There's a set of rules at the top of the page. And we don't ask questions. If you break a rule, you can't come back and say, oh, well, I didn't know. You're gone. Simple as that. And for us, it works great. People love our site. They appreciate it. There's a lot of good information and things about Niagara. And if you're interested, there's also an American group. My buddy Max Eddy on the American side runs a group called the Real Old Falls Street People. And you'll see lots of great photographs and things there of old-time Niagara.
Yeah, and they're both amazing. I'm a member of both of these groups. They're amazing groups. And if you're a history nerd like I am, just going through them and reading all the past posts and seeing these photographs. But what's even more incredible is, like you said, the sense of community in that group and how great everybody is. That if you go in with out of ignorance and ask a question, no one's going to make fun of you for not knowing it. But you're going to get so many people assisting you and helping you out and giving you information.
It's not like some of those groups. Sometimes somebody is searching some ancestor that lived here. And for me and a couple other people, it's always great for us to try and dig it out. Like, at least find out if they're buried in the area. Like, our Drummond Hill Cemetery. We had a man there from 1876 till 1913. He was the guy that buried people. He kept track of everybody he buried. He would tell you what the weather was like that day, what the flowers at the funeral looked like, who the pallbearers were, and then comments, if he knew them or knew of them, he would write a few comments about them, like, oh, he was a really good guy, blah, 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 used to bring Mrs. Smith's biscuits, and, you know, things like, little things like that, eh? And that's he incredible. Did this for 30-something years, and I've got a book, and everything's listed alphabetically, year by year. Well, I had somebody contact me looking for a family member they thought lived up in Old Drummondville, which is where this cemetery is. So it took me 2 minutes. I just grabbed the book, looked, found the name. I said, oh, yeah, here it is. And then I typed it out and sent it to him.
Yeah, you know, it's incredible. Like just the history alone of these two amazing cities. And I don't think a lot of people around the world appreciate the sheer majesty of Niagara Falls. The magic of the falls themselves. Yeah. And, you know, the people on both sides of the falls are magical people. That's why I'm so glad to have met you, my friend.
Well, you know, it used to be, you go back to the 30s, 40s, even into the 50s, the community then on both sides of the river were much more closer knit because you had families living on both sides, you know?
Yep.
Cousins and nieces and nephews like that. And it was a different time, that's for sure.
It was, but it's still a wonderful place. It's still my favorite place to go. And Misha Malcolm, if you come back into town again, we're going to take Patrick up on that offer, and we're going to go see some of them Canadian sites too.
Oh, yeah, I got a few sites for you to see.
Well, then we'll wrap it up here. We will talk soon again, my friend.
Great seeing you again. We'll hook up again soon, I hope.
Absolutely. So from Patrick in Niagara Falls, Ontario, Canada, this is Brian in just outside of Niagara Falls, New York, US of A, saying good night.
See you later. Have a good one.
Oh, can we retire the jokes, please? We never did the jokes in the beginning.